All right, welcome back. So tonight, doing the last talk on wise intention as we move along through the Eightfold Path, which is part of the Four Noble Truths. And so a question we're going to hold as we explore tonight's topic is, how do we give voice to our wisdom, our understanding that we're cultivating in our practice? How do we actually have that show up in our lives? How do we live with a place of integrity, a sense of kindness, of non-harm? And intentionality and the link of intention is so critical around this. Because it can be really hard to transform our actions if we don't have that intention supporting it. That intention is that wise intention, is that aim, that direction. And what aims at is our wisdom, our understanding. Now, often we think about the traditional ways of describing wise intention, such as non-ill will and renunciation. And sometimes those are a little harder to get a handle on. They seem a little bit abstract. They're not something that maybe is as concrete as they could be for some of us, certainly for me. What I'm talking about that is having a kind of a felt sense of what it is like. You know, non-harm, we kind of, okay, I know how not to harm, but have maybe a way of translating this to our own lives, in our own practice. And that's what I want to talk about tonight, is how do we translate something like wise view and wise intention in particular into our lives? How do we translate it so it makes sense for how we are wired, how we have developed as human beings, and how we've learned to understand the Dharma? Because when we find our kind of own personal way of expressing it, then it's much more meaningful. It makes much more sense versus something I'm trying to borrow from language some 2,600 years ago and an English translation of that to boot. So translating wise intention into our lives is the title of this talk. Now there's the first two links of the Eightfold Path help us really connect with our internal sense of motivation, of why we want to practice, and also our wisdom of understanding. So we can define the first fold, the wise view, is this understanding what causes suffering, what causes liberation, understanding this in a deep way. You know, so this is what we cultivate as practitioners. That cultivation itself, if it's just a cultivation without an actual way of practicing it, of bringing life into it, it has limited value. And that's why this wise intention is so helpful, because it connects us with our wisdom. Intentionality connects us to the next section that we're moving into next month at the Eightfold Path. This is really the whole sila, or the ethical part, that includes three whole folds. One is going to be on wise speech, one's going to be on wise action, and the final one is on a wise livelihood. So I think it's very interesting how the Buddha explicitly said it's important to pay attention to how we act in the world, how we use our communication, how we use our bodies, and let that be informed from our wisdom. In this way, our actions start to really align with ethics, with integrity. And it's interesting, it's not so much an external authority that's telling us how we should be or shouldn't be, but it's really this internal authority that starts to come forth. And that's why this first two links of wisdom, or wise view representing wisdom, and wise intention come from this internal place. Now, this external sense of ethics that we perhaps may have learned as children or through society, it often has that I should in my head. I should do this. I should be this way. I shouldn't steal. I shouldn't harm. I shouldn't hurt someone. But sometimes it's there's that pressure. Like if nobody was looking, maybe I'll take that extra cookie. Of course, maybe you're wanting all the extra cookies to leave tonight. You know, that sense of, okay, if no one's around, I can kind of shade that. Or perhaps it's just, okay, I remember I was listening to a song that the line was that I want to do right, but not right now. Not right now. So this kind of internal motivation or internal authority, it doesn't matter if anyone ever sees that you've done this or not done this. It's like, you know, for yourself, okay, I did a choice that was aligned with my wisdom, with my understanding, my sense of integrity. Now, the way that we practice Buddhism and meditation and the Dharma in the West, in some ways, is a little backwards. There's a little bit of a misordering of it. This is just the way it's unfolded. I'm not sure exactly what the reasons were. But if you think about the Eightfold Path, it doesn't start with meditation. But how many of you started this whole practice by learning how to meditate? You know, that's how I did. When I teach an introductory meditation class, I don't talk about the Four Noble Truths on day one. I talk about how to meditate. I kind of slip it in a sneaky way. But it's not overtly, like, here's the philosophy. It's like, how do you actually see for yourself? How do you actually practice? How do you see this is not as an abstraction, but actually in your own life? Maybe this is a reaction to kind of the faith-based religions in our country when this tradition came to the West. You know, maybe trying to let people not have to be based on belief or faith, but through their own understanding, through where they see for themselves. It also starts to give you a very tangible way of experiencing the practice instead of this abstract idea. So we do, there's, but just to say, there is a slight, I don't know if I'm going to say distortion, but just a different way we experience it. And for many of us, we learn to meditate, and then we start to learn about the philosophy. Then we start to learn about the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path after we've already learned how to meditate. But the Eightfold Path starts with this wise view and understanding. How does the Four Noble Truths, basically, wise intention, how do we actually act in the world? And the final section is the meditation. It's the wise effort toward meditation, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. And we'll probably see that these Eightfold Path loops all kind of interact. They don't stay in isolation. They start to reinforce and inform each other. Now, since we often learn the Eightfold Path in reverse order, we learn it first through the meditation, and then we start to understand the Four Noble Truths. We can actually take advantage of that. We can actually use that as a way to make the practice not so abstract or intellectual, but actually something I can see for myself. In other words, you know, can you see how dukkha actually arises in your mind, in your heart, in your relationship? Can you see the origination of that dukkha? Can you see the cessation of that dukkha? So we start to see that in more and more clear and deep ways that transforms us in profound ways. So this is actually, I think, a beneficial way to practice. I don't know if I had my choice, which I guess I kind of do as a teacher, but I often do think we first learn how to relate to this mind. How do we relate to this body? How do we actually see things for how they are? Because usually we see things through our level of distortion, our prejudice, our projections, our trauma. There's so many different lenses that we see through, and we rarely see things how they actually are. And learning how to see things how they actually are allows us to be transformed by that seeing. And then all these teachings actually really come to life. Because they're not something abstract, I can actually see that real time in this mind, in this body. That clear seeing also gives this capacity, is this capacity to see and receive the feedback of life. I think that's one of the gifts of Dharma, as we start to notice where there is dukkha, where there is suffering. And that starts to, we see that and we realize, oh, maybe there needs to be a course correction. Maybe I need to see how I'm perceiving this moment, change my attitude, take ownership for my actions. But regardless of whether we start the practice from a meditative perspective first, really learning the meditative mindfulness and concentration, or if we start from the philosophy side, however we do it, the essential piece is how to make the teachings our own, how to actually integrate them to the way that we know them in a deep way, in a way that is unshakable. And so sometimes the archaic descriptions need some way of translating it so they become alive and meaningful in this mind and body. How does it show up when you're a parent? How does it show up when you're working in relationships? How does it show up when you're stuck in traffic? You know, how does it show up in when you have these health crises? These are all ways to see how does your practice actually show up? How do you actually see things in a different way? Sometimes it's very spontaneous. You just realize that your old repertoire of acting with things have fallen away. It just doesn't make sense to pick those up anymore. Other times it's really important to bring extra energy to those. And that's where intentionality comes in. I bring my intention to express my wisdom, to manifest my wisdom, to act from that place of wisdom. So in my own way of practicing, in my own years of practicing for almost 3 decades now, the first 10 years or so, I really didn't know much about the traditional teachings. I mean, my teacher talked about them, but he kind of really interpreted them from a different perspective in many ways. And not until I went to something like the Dedicated Dharma Practitioner Program, Dedicated Practitioner Program, the DPP through Spirit Rock, and I started to actually hear the teachings more directly. That was my first exposure in some ways to them in that, how they actually were originally taught. And yet, they seemed very pertinent and alive. I could see the practice I had been doing prepared me to see those not as an abstractness, but actually as something I could see in my own mind, my own body. And so the encouragement for this talk is for each one of us to find a way of translating the teachings so we can see them, to make them really alive for us. And for myself, there was a single lens that I often used and continue to use to help make sense of all the Dharma, of all the teachings. And finding what that is for each one of us is so helpful. So for myself, I found this lens of understanding this nature of self, of anatta, of non-self, to be very compelling, very interesting to try to get a sense of that, to open to it. And using that as this lens that I would see all the Dharma from. And it was interesting that lens formed the basis of the intentionality of this wise intention. That wise intention then translates into action. So let's kind of flush that out a bit here. Now, non-self or anatta is one of the fundamental characteristics of existence that the Buddha described, that there's impermanence, there's dukkha, there's also the lack of a substantial sense of self. So this is a really interesting thing. If you've never been exposed to this teaching, it seems contrary to our kind of lived experience, right? Because of course, here I am having this experience. I'm talking, you're listening. I had some cookies. I had too many cookies. I had not enough cookies. But there's a sense of me who's really engaged in that. You know, and then there's the me who came and drove here or walked here or took the bus, me who turned on my computer to join us from online. So that sense of me seems like it's continuous, that it's not changing, that it's forever there. And then if you also reflect that when you really experience a lot of suffering in your life, it's often revolved around that sense of me who's having that experience, right? I'm the one who had that heartbreak, who's having this grief, who's having this loss, who's upset about this situation personally or nationally or globally. There's a sense of me that the more invested I am, the more suffering I have. There's also the experience that when you have something you really like and really love and cherish, when that fades away and ends and dies, there's suffering that comes from that. But at the core of all those is that sense of me who's having that experience, right? And then think about today, all the different mind states that you went through. Some of them were pleasant, some of them were painful, but you're kind of like the star of it, right? You're like the star of your own favorite sitcom or limited series on Netflix. You know, you're the one who's the camera's always focused on you. Your inner narrative, your own experience, right? So the Buddha realized that that is actually just another thing that's arising in the moment. It's actually conditional, meaning that when those conditions go away, it falls away, it fades. It's not substantial, right? Now that sounds like a bad thing from the self's perspective, right? It's like, so I'm practicing to get rid of myself. Why? I'm going to leave. You know, but yet that we start to see that there's a lot of freedom that comes when we're not defined in that narrow way. There's a way of deep interconnection. There's a deep sense of liberation and release that comes from that. We sometimes talk about awakening as this heart's release, the heart's opening, right? Because there's this release of that separation. And we still know how to do our jobs and interrelate and be connected from this kind of navigational self. We just don't believe that self as being constant and solid, right? So that's kind of a quick overview of that. Now, the sense of self is interesting. Like if you're like me, when I really wanted to understand it and see through it, I would work really hard at trying to do that. But I realized over the years that the sense of me who's looking to find the sense of me is just the sense of me in a more subtle way, right? It's just kind of this more subtle capacity of looking, right? So there's a way that it has to release from us. We can't make it release. It falls away on its own accord. Some teachers talk about it. It's like an accident. Like awakening is an accident. Enlightenment's an accident that we can't control. Well, we can make ourselves more accident prone by practicing, right? By practicing in the right way. And so this lens of that sense of self starts to become, can be very helpful. So I'm just suggesting this is sharing my process, but please use that to extrapolate whatever is alive for you in your practice, right? Maybe it's impermanence. Maybe it's dukkha. Maybe it's something like kindness or compassion. Something that is like your heart just, you don't have to work at it. It's like your heart is really interested in understanding it and deepening around it. So non-self, it's an insight when you see through it. Sometimes it falls away momentarily. Sometimes it falls away in deeper ways. And again, it's outside of our control, the timing of it. And yet we can start to become very curious and interested in how that sense of self gets more firm, more solid, more established. And also we can start to notice when that sense of self becomes less firm, less established, less obvious. Right? So this is something every one of us has experienced. If I told you something that was really upsetting and you got really charged by it, your sense of self, if you look back, step back and notice, your sense of self would be really solid. When I have an opinion that I'm really trying to defend, I'm trying to protect against, when I'm really upset or angry or charged, the sense of self can get really solid with that. It's possible to have emotions just flow through without anchoring into that sense of self. But when I'm using that, I'm feeling this, I'm really hurt or angry, I really believe this, I think you're wrong. I think I'm right. That sense of self is really solid. Now contrast that with when you're practicing meditation, or maybe you're just hanging out and watching the wind go through the trees. Or you're feeling very still connecting with maybe a newborn or a friend, or you're just completely present. There's not a lot that needs to be done in the moment. That simply being there is enough. There's a sense of deep connection with life. Notice how the sense of self is much quieter. Mindfulness practice is designed to start to loosen that sense of self, even from the get-go. You know, as I often say this, that the instructions aren't, okay, sit down, tense your body, you know, find something to judge about yourself and really stick to it, you know. Keep reinforcing it. Find more and more ways to judge about yourself. Okay, that's if we want to enhance the sense of self. Yeah, that's how we would say. But instead we say, sit down, relax the body, relax the mind. Allow this moment to be just how it is. Okay, when you're allowing the moment to be just how it is, the sense of self it's not activated in the same way. It becomes less employed. Right? So you can start to see the sense of what enhances and solidifies the sense of self, and what starts to loosen the sense of self, that becomes something we can actually get a handle on. At least I found very helpful. And that becomes the basis of wise intention. Right? Am I forming the sense of self? Am I reinforcing it? Or am I loosening it? Am I softening it? I want to do just a quick aside. Because we talk about the sense of self often as the goal from a Buddhist perspective is to see through it and to release it. And yet, for many of us, the sense of self needs to be developed into a place of wholeness, of health, of integrity. And sometimes we think that since I kind of thought this too, I can jump over this painful sense of self by just going to non-self, right? Can I not have to go through that? And yet, it doesn't work, right? It may work for the short time if you can control your circumstances, if you can control the input of your life. But if you're actually in relationship with people, it will reassert itself. Thich Ram Dass said, if you think you're enlightened, go spend a week with your in-laws, right? And see what arises from that. Or, you know, fill in the blank of whoever is the most charged for you. So not to negate the work that is often very helpful to do. You know, I think it's essential for all of us to develop a healthy sense of self. You know, a sense of self-esteem, a sense of feeling like I'm basically okay. You know, basically lovable. And then from there, we can start to examine the nature of it. That sense of self often does form around those painful patterns, those painful self-beliefs. That's a very powerful way that the self gets engaged. It's also, if you ever try to do this, that kind of work around this in the psychology of it, you sometimes may find that, okay, the pattern just keeps on going. I may examine it, I can figure out where it's come from, and I've traced these, you know, back when I was a kid and all those things. But it keeps coming up, you know, and why is that? One of the hidden benefits is that it reinforces the sense of self. That if you really deeply let go of the pattern, you're deeply letting go of a part, the sense of self in that. Right? And part of us doesn't want to do that. We'd rather be a miserable, anxious, you know, person than whatever it means to the sense of self not to be there. So this quality of intentionality, wise intention, so I'm trying to find our way through with this, is something that's a life force around the Dharma, like non-self was and is for me, that can become this handle into wise intention, right? Because how can I be kind? How can I have non-ill will? How can I do renunciation? It's so easy that to slip into that sense of I should, right? I need to do that to be a good practitioner. But if I transform it to the lens of, am I reinforcing the sense of self? Or am I dissolving the sense of self? I have a felt sense of that. Then that becomes a very different intentionality that I can actually see real time how that shows up. And it actually works very well with non-harm and with kindness and with generosity as other intentions. Because when I'm acting from a generous place, my sense of self hopefully isn't so active. right? As we spent a month with that in the Paramis, was it last year or the year before? Just last year? So last year with the generosity, we talked about the ways we can sometimes distort it. Like, look how generous I'm being, you know? Aren't I a generous person? Versus that sense of really releasing, of letting go, and yet connecting without an agenda. Right? So generosity, non-harm. You know, if I'm really charged and triggered and wanting to lash out against someone, that sense of me is so strong, right? I'm seeing how my sense of me is loading up. If I realize that, what's the path of letting go of that? Often the expression of that will be non-harm. Right? Same thing with ill will, as we talked about earlier this month. Hatred is, it can sometimes be hard to let go of. You know, it's that resentment, all the different shading of ill will, of, you know, especially this day and age. There's so much to be upset about, to be angry about in the world. And we can choose to kind of go into that. Okay, I want to enhance that. I want to find something to hate about some person or something in the world. And how that, you know, it's so gripping, right? It's hard to let go. Oh, I'm not supposed to do that as a Dharma practitioner. Sorry, I'm trying to let go of it. Reframing it as, am I enhancing the sense of self? Am I reinforcing that sense of self? With hatred, we do that. If I release the hatred, then what arises instead is some other quality, some other way of relating that's not reinforcing that sense of me, that sense of self. So finding what works for you, what makes it alive for you. Now, as a teacher, I can point directions, I can throw things out, but only you know what makes it you alive, what makes it alive for your practice. If you're a time of your practice when you're feeling a little of the doldrums, a little bit dull, not quite sure what's motivating you, noticing what it really brought you to the practice in the first place. Sometimes returning to that can be very helpful and bringing that understanding forth. So it becomes this intentionality, this expression of wise intention that then leads into your actions. So really what we're kind of talking about with this link of wise intention is how to integrate it into our lives. Right? How do we actually test it? How do we practice it? How do we give expression to it? Because we can have a great insight on a retreat or in a sit. You know, this deep seeing of something, some aspect of Dharma. And we can talk about it, or you can write a book about it. But yet, if we don't really practice it, it has very limited value. And the way to practice it is to find the areas of our life that it's harder to show up in. Right? The teachings, or not the, I guess the study around becoming a master or an expert in some field is like 10,000 hours of practice. But it's not just any kind of 10,000 hours of practice. I could name a couple of things I've done, probably 10,000 hours I'm still not very good at. It's really practicing just outside of your competency, practicing where it's hard, practicing not so much that you're discouraged, but you're constantly growing. And so finding, let's say it's something like non-self. So I want to really pay attention to when that self grips. Maybe it's around kindness. My main value is I want to be kind, right? So when does that kindness not show up? You know, not in a way of kind of negating that or pushing it down, because that doesn't work. It's eventually going to kind of spring up. Becoming curious. Okay, my heart is just closed here. This is going contrary to my value, to my intention. And not using it as a chance to judge ourselves or evaluate, but more, how do I see? Why is the heart closed right now? Why is there this sense of separation, of distance? So why is intention? And how can we translate it into our lives? into our own understanding. Because each one of we of us here in this room, you've been practicing for some length of time, right? Might be a few weeks to a few months or decades or, you know, many, many years from that whole range. And there's wisdom that starts to grow, right? So that wisdom, that understanding, how do I see life in a different way? What feels more true to me? What feels more accurate? Which way of seeing the life leads to less suffering? To more joy, more happiness? Let that become an intention. And then from the intention, let that lead into your actions. And if you're struggling with some action, I just find myself keep, you know, coming into the wise, unwise speech or, you know, unwise actions. Check the intention, bring awareness to that and see what arises from that. All right, then I'm going to stop there. Let's just take a couple moments to sit together in quiet. Letting those words settle. All right, I want to just share the homework. So we won't have a chance to do a discussion next week, but I just wanted to offer it in case you'd like to take this talk into your daily life. So it's around translating wise intention into our lives. So reflect on what's most alive for you in your Dharma practice. You know, reflect, what is most alive? Maybe it's just meditating. Maybe it's Sangha. Maybe it's, you know, connection. Maybe it's kindness. Maybe it's non-self. Whatever is alive for you. And another way of phrasing it, what naturally has a level of engagement, curiosity, and interest that you don't have to put much effort into? Like you're sitting and you're listening to a Dharma talk and the teacher starts to talk about this and you're like, oh, I want to hear more about that. I want to lean into that. I want to look at that more deeply. Look at that and form that into an intention. Form that into an intention that becomes a link into your actions, right? So an intentionality you can check in with, because you can hold the intention much more easily than all these different rules and guidelines, right? I can hold this single intention, and from there, everything else kind of follows through with that. Keep it simple and accessible. This is wise intention reinterpreted so it's relevant to your life. So I'd like to open to any sharing or questions, both about this topic or other Dharma questions, both here online or in person. And if you're in person, Pecky has volunteered or been volunteered to come around and give you the mic. And then online, you can just raise your virtual hand.
Hi, Tim. I was actually just having a conversation yesterday with a family member who's been studying meditation practice,
yeah,
some principles of Buddhism, and he was just talking about how the thing that many of these principles make a tremendous amount of sense to him, but the thing he's struggling with the most is not self.
Mm.
As many of us have, and he's a very literally minded person, extremely literally minded, and so he couldn't get past this concept of like, no matter what, there is still this concept of a self who is the one that, you know, wants a cookie or, you know, decides to take the bus. And so when I was sort of talking through the concepts with him about what happens when you start to interrogate what that self is and what it means to kind of let go of that self, he kept coming back to this principle, yeah, but there's still a self who's who's recognizing that. And so he kept kind of swirling in this rabbit hole of the literalness of the language, mm-hmm. of the term self, that the concept of self doesn't evaporate. So then what does not self mean? And so we were kind of going in a circle that got very hard to talk about. So I'm just wondering if you could maybe double click on this a little bit more about how, for the literal minded of us out there, who,
the double click.
Yeah.
Okay. The modern language. That's great. Well, to kind of riff off that for a second, the technology, the double click, I sometimes like to describe the sense of self and kind of the way it becomes very sneaky as the operating system of our computer. We turn on the operating system and it loads up and we can do all the things we want to do with it. But we don't realize that the operating system is actually something that's constructed, right? It's not the same on a Mac versus a Chromebook versus a Microsoft. And the operating system is one way of describing that sense of self. It's kind of operating in the background. And if someone's very literal about it, I would say that I would start to kind of tease out the difference between awareness and the sense of me who's being aware, right? To see that there's actually could be two different things. Because what happens is that there's awareness is just this here, right? And then we claim that as me, my little awareness, and we see it through that lens. I'm having this experience, right? And so what happens is we're kind of releasing that quality of awareness, of that ownership of the awareness, back into its more universal source. Like this cup of water, this is my cup of water, it's in my cup. But if I poured it out, and let's say, we don't have all the impermeable surfaces, it would eventually find its way back to the ocean. It would evaporate back into the ocean, go back into it. So that's one way basically, it's like that sense of self is like, you can also define it as the big self versus the small self. This is more like the, Hindu type way of working with it. That the big sense of self is just very expansive. There's a sense of me, there's a sense of knowing, but it's not tied to that solid quality sense of self. Another way to approach it is to notice how constant is that sense of self. Are you always feeling the exact same thing? Sometimes you're very angry, sometimes you're very hopeful, sometimes you're very sad, happy. There's these different senses of self that arises with that. But basically, for people, what I would tend to do is just say, okay, well, that's something that we can keep looking at some point. But if someone's kind of really stuck in that model there, arguing with it doesn't really work so well. But because they have to see it for themselves, they have to actually see it as a direct experience. And one way to look at it, there's so many different techniques and processes and all of them kind of sometimes are helpful, but eventually they all can kind of trip over themselves. But one is like, okay, where is that sense of self? Can I actually locate it? How solid is it?
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. It's almost what I'm hearing is not whether or not a sense of self sort of technically exists, but how fixed is that sense of self?
That's right.
So, that's good.
Yeah, how fixed, and also a nice way to think of it as there's a relative sense of self or mm-hmm. the navigational self, yeah. and there's the more the absolute sense of self.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. What else? Anyone else like to ask? Okay, online we got a couple of people. Let's go with Karen first, and then we'll go with Jeff and Amanda. So you do have to give you permission to unmute, probably. Okay, go ahead. You should be able to do it now, Karen.
I was wondering if you could speak on, you mentioned, I'm using the wrong word, being stuck in the sense of self. Like there is resistance to maybe want to change the self. You're to expand the sense of self, resistance to the change despite suffering, despite dukkha. I didn't write it down. I was busy listening, but there's just the sense of self, and there's the resistance to see that part of self. I wonder if you could speak to that resistance.
Resistance to seeing it? I think the context of, I think what I was saying, was talking about is if we have a kind of a painful pattern that we're trying to release, but it just kind of keeps coming back. Sometimes you don't realize that the investment is that it establishes that sense of self. Was that it, or was that a different one?
Yes, that's it. Like there's an investment, and you're not even sure what the investment is, but you can feel the resistance. No matter, like you said, you were saying, like, I can sit 10,000 hours.
Right.
And very little movement occurs. And so there's that resistance to allow it to arise.
Well, that sense of like 10,000 hours is like that working kind of outside, slightly outside of our comfort zone. So this territory comes in, the way it comes in with that resistance is, let me see if I can loop all this together for you. And it makes me, if it's, I'm answering your question, you can let me know. But basically, you can start to notice that when you're, that assumption, okay, this is a sense of me, I don't want to go there, I don't want to let go of that. The way to kind of elicit that or to really highlight it is, who would I be if I'm not doing this pattern? You know, when I start to feel myself being less defined, and I feel a little scared by that, a little bit uneasy with that. Because if I'm not the person who's a failure, that person who is struggling, who am I? What am I? And that sense of not knowing who and what you are, that's like a glimpse from the sense of self side into the non-self. I'm starting to glimpse that. But from the sense of self, it's terrifying because I'm not going to exist. And I want to kind of reestablish myself. And yet, who I am outside of that pattern is actually more my true nature of what I actually am. And so it's like there's these kind of two sides of it. There's the side of learning to have some courage and some trust that I can kind of get into that territory that I don't know who and what I am, but I want to try to release into it. And the other side of it is this heart really yearning for that deep peace, that deep connection, that sense of release. And for most, I don't know, for most people, for many people, including myself, when that sense of self really falls away, there's often a quality of, why did I make such a big deal about this? You know, this, you know, it seemed like it was so not good on the other side of it, but here it's actually, there's an ease and a quiet. It's like, this is so simple, so much simpler than I ever thought it was. Does that kind of get to your question at all?
Yes. And then, so are you just supposed to sit with that idea that you are resistant? Like, it's not going anywhere.
Could you give me a little bit more sense of what the resistance is for you?
I think it's, like I had brought it up in previous talks of I have a chronic condition and I'm resistant to it. I don't know how I'm resistant to it, but it's just not, I'm not taking care of myself. So you just, you know, it's acknowledging that I do, but you have to move forward with it. And there's a resistance to, judgment or something. There's a resistance to, I asked this question at a sit on Thursday about judgment, and Lyndall had brought up about judgment, but there's even a resistance to that. Like, there's a resistance to just step off and see what arises, and having it be a part of the sense of self. And maybe I can sit for 10,000 hours and it's still going to be a resistance. What's what am I not seeing for the resistance?
Yeah, that's probably the biggest thing, is what am I not seeing about it?
Right. And I welcome it. I'm not.
Yeah.
Because I had addressed some other things that had arisen, and it was like this energy that I thought I would never change, that I would never see, that I would open to some of those emotions of fear and vulnerability. And because it was just such a sense of self of who I was. So I have this feed of welcoming of change and letting go of part of a sense of self that I enjoyed and I liked, and it was protective. And then this part is not moving anywhere. And I'm like, I don't want to sit 10,000 hours and get nowhere. And I just, that resistance and that sense of self is to how it is to do with resistance of change.
Yeah. And so that resistance, a lot of it forms around, there's something about the attitude or the way of relating to it, which is basically aversive, you know, to make it really simple. And the trick is to, how can I start to trick myself into not resisting it, or allow my heart to meet it? And it's a process, you know, it's a process of, can I see it in a more full way? Can I see the different aspects of it? So trying to leave with curiosity. So something like chronic pain, try to reinterpret it not as pain, but as a sensation, you know, or as pressure or something like that. So you start to relate to it from a different perspective. I think, you know, writing things, you know, actually writing by hand can be very powerful. You can write out, okay, I'm resisting this. And then kind of give yourself a prompt and let yourself kind of die, you know, let the subconscious start to come forth. Because sometimes we can be thinking about things and pondering it, but to actually put it on paper kind of clarifies it. So it might be a question like, you know, what's maybe two questions, you know, what am I resisting? Or maybe what's the unseen payoff of this? You know, how does this benefit me? You know, those kind of qualities. And maybe don't worry so much about the sense of self right now, but just try to understand the nature of it more fully. That itself, because sometimes the sense of self lends, sometimes we kind of get in the way of just this full, deep acknowledgement. But the full, deep acknowledgement is in service of that.
Mm-hmm. That's perfect. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. All right. So Jeff or Amanda?
Yeah. Thank you, Tim. Your response to the last question, talking about those patterns and talking about the self, the habits that we fall into. A couple of weeks ago, in our small group, that was a lot of our discussion around how to reflect on what right intention is for us. And a lot of it was reflecting on the habits, reflecting on the patterns that we fall into, and, you know, reconsidering them or thinking how does that align with my right view? But I'm curious if there's a felt experience that's not reflective or planning ahead. Is there like an in the moment felt experience, or is there a distinction between that felt experience of right intention as you're reflecting? Okay. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you. Yeah.
You just popped off. If there's a difference between the felt experience of kind of right intention when you're reflecting back on an action versus when you're in the moment or engaging with others or, you know, addressing a matter with right intention. Is there a difference in that felt experience?
Well, between the sense of self and not the sense of self with that, or more around how engaged you are with your wise intention?
Yeah, so that latter part. So it seemed like in our discussion, a lot of it was I can reflect on what right intention feels like to me. But it feels like assessing how I behaved in an engagement, right, or how I conducted myself, rather than like I'm in the moment and I want to have right intention as I'm engaging in a conversation or what have you?
For myself, wise intention has a much more kind of embodied quality. It's not so much me kind of evaluating or thinking through. There can be a place for that, right? To kind of see, oh, wow, I really kind of got into a mess there, or I felt like I was really unskillful, and I can kind of go through it. But in the moment, it's much more simple. It's like maybe even thinking like, okay, can I feel my heart? Can I connect from a place of my heart? Can I notice the sense of integrity or that sense of harmony internally? Or do I feel the sense of dissonance? Like if I'm saying something that's not quite true or is inaccurate or an outright lie, the body tightens up. There's that incongruency that I can tune into. So I often use in the moment is really simple, the sense of intentionality. And, you know, again, sometimes if I'm feeling like I'm really in shaky ground here, I'm not sure how to navigate it, maybe going back into that intention. Okay, my core intention here is just truthfulness. My core intention is non-harm or kindness. Okay, how can I come from that place there? But really, it's like those three, there's like the first three links, wise view, wise intention, and then the action parts. Those all have to kind of, they all feedback. They kind of really interrelate with each other. So you try something, you realize, okay, I'm kind of, it's off. Then I can go back and reevaluate that. And sometimes you can do that right in the moment, sometimes after the fact. Does that kind of help a little bit?
It does, thank you, yeah.
All right, over here we've got Jonah.
So a little while ago, I came to this epiphany that, in every moment, I can always just choose to let go. That there's always that choice.
Yes.
And in the moment, it feels very freeing. But then the complexity of reality and the, like, this self-industrial complex catches back up with me. Mm-hmm. And I lose sight of that. But do you have any advice on that or anything to say to that?
Around the simple intention of letting go and then and how that selfing process kicks back in?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's... Let's see. Is there particular areas that comes up for you, or is it like every time you kind of forget or it kind of falls away?
I think it mostly comes up with like wanting things I don't have or wanting the situation to be different. Yeah, wanting.
Okay, yeah, so that sense of wanting. So you might try putting some compassion into it, you know, relating to it from a place of compassion. Because wisdom by itself sometimes is a little too harsh and kind of gets us into knots sometimes. Okay, I'm supposed to be letting go, but yet I really want this. Okay, so I'm kind of in opposition to how I really am in the moment. Compassion, okay, I'm wanting this. Turn toward that quality. So here's, I guess, the basic to really change things. We can't just do it because sometimes it doesn't work, let's say it that way, to kind of will ourselves to try to do it a certain way. But we can use investigation and a quality of turning more deeply to that pattern. So wanting, for example, I can want something. Let's say I really want some experience or some possession or some relationship or some sense of health or role or whatever it might be. As I feel that sense of wanting, if I can meet that, the pain of that, the lack of that with compassion and start to use that as a gateway into a deeper understanding of it. Okay, what does it actually feel like as a body experience? Is it a great place to start with and keep coming back? What do I feel like this represents? You know, if I get this thing, then I will be this way, right? Notice the story that it tells. And sometimes if you hang out with there, you realize that it's actually trying to fill a much deeper lack that that won't be filled by anything you could want. Right? So then there's a deeper way of looking with it, opening to it and meeting it. So using compassion and investigation as a way of turning into it, to learn, open to a more deep way, and seeing what's kind of underneath the wanting. Right? Because trying to talk yourself out of wanting, it's easy to kind of slip into denying the wanting or judging the fact that you're wanting. You know, and then you've got to let go of the fact that you're judging the fact that you're wanting. And pretty soon it's like, you know, you just, we're lost in that complexity. But compassion, okay, where's the pain here? Where's the hurt right now? Where's the dukkha right now? Can I be with that? Does that help a little bit?
Yes, thank you.
Thanks for the question. All right, what else is out there? All right. And then we'll get to you next, Monica.
Hello. Hopefully this is a simple question, but regarding practicing with the intention of developing more skill and practicing on the kind of line of where is uncomfortable. So in trying to establish my meditation practice, it's like pretty easy to meditate in the morning because it fits into the schedule nicely, mm-hmm. right? But I notice that when I meditate in the morning, it's just like so chill. Nothing is happening.
Yeah.
Just wake up, everything is super easy. But then if I sit down and meditate at night, it's just like chaos. Because like the avalanche of everything that happened through the day just like comes crashing down. So I guess just wondering about, does it mean that I should practice at night? Like, yeah.
Yeah, there's I have two thoughts around that. You know, basically, you know, both are helpful. I mean, you can make a big argument for practicing when it's easy, so you can, you know, give yourself a respite to really yourself, you know, deep into the practice and have a different quality of tranquility and calmness and steadiness. They can start to transform those other times. But I think it's also really helpful to sit in the middle of it, too. So I think, you know, if you can, try to do both. You know, give yourself some of the morning time when you feel really established, and then when you go into the evening time, just, okay, what's here? And also realize that sometimes the technique or the attitude needs to shift and adjust around it. Because that's one of the downsides of having the tranquil, calm morning meditation is you judge the chaotic evening meditation by comparison. Right? So, okay, how can I meet this? How can I sit in the middle of this? I think it's great to go sit in the middle of a noisy area. You know, practice sitting with talking going around. And, okay, how can I still practice in the midst of that? Because, yeah, so it's kind of playing with that. And sometimes the capacity is like, okay, I feel like I want to really grow into that. Other times I need to back off and find where it's easy. Yeah. All right, Monica. So up here in the front. Thanks, Peggy.
Thanks, Tim. It's another non-self question. For me, the way non-self kind of started breaking down is kind of like I started thinking of myself as a series of stories I tell myself about myself. Hmm. And to my considerable shock, turns out that some of those stories are lies. Hmm. And so I've been really pleased that I've identified that it's not easy, and I've replaced some of these stories, but, you know, it's really some of what I've done is really replaced them, and living mostly without, you know, habit mind or, you know, whatever way to put it, feels really complex. So just to borrow this metaphor and shorten my question, like, what would it be like to be without the operating system and just in assembly language, like always mindful all the time? And it seemed to me that you have worked more towards kind of like in not replacing the stories, but really not being dependent so much on the stories. And I'm just kind of curious if you want to comment, like, has this become easy? Is this always like a daily struggle? Is that like a good goal to have, just to like have more like constant mindfulness is tiring. Like there's a reason we've developed evolutionarily habits, and even prejudices probably come from the fact that we want to like make things simple and categorize. So like, how does that, sorry if that's too personal, but like, how does that work for you? Is that like, does it become easy or?
Yes, a great question. A lot of nice nuances. And just I want to highlight a couple aspects of the question before I answer it. One is that replacement of the story, that we realize, okay, there's all these stories I tell myself, and some of these stories really are not accurate or lies. And that kind of, that's part of this journey of developing a more healthy sense of self, right? And so like, I'm always a failure. It's more that, okay, I'm competent. You know, that's more wholesome, right? It allows us to live more easily. Now, in terms of the sense of story, that sense of inner narrative, at some point, there's not the sense of you who's having, it doesn't make any sense. It just falls away, right? There's like, I'm not really having a story about myself. Because, I mean, it's not all the time. You know, sometimes I do, but there's also a lot of time when I don't. And there's simply and believe it or not, the mind actually prefers that. There's a quality simply being at rest. And what I would point to a little bit is the way that we often are mindful sometimes has too much effort to it. Okay, sometimes it's like, okay, I'm walking in a snowstorm of my thoughts. I'm trying to find one, you know, trying to find the guide rope to find back to the present moment. But I'm always have to really work hard to do that. Other times, mindfulness is much more of a natural quality. You know, a nice gateway is to do some nature awareness. That you're just sitting in nature and you go through to your different senses. Maybe close your eyes and just let the ears take in all the sounds around you in a very simple, immediate way. That maybe your mind wants to put a story, but you can just let the direct experience come in. Do the same thing with smell and with sight. And there's a way that there's this natural quality of mindfulness that's without the story, without that inner narrative, without defining yourself or someone else. Now, in terms of navigating the world, it actually makes them easier, right? Because our stories often get in our way, right? They actually get in the way of how things actually are, how I think I should be or how you should be. If I'm not running a narrative, I'm actually able to meet the person how they actually are. I'm able to be much more spontaneous and fluid. But when those stories are really believed in, the whole system becomes kind of rigid and locked. Okay, like I'm, you know, not the person who would do this. I would not ask a question or do that. And if I don't believe it, that sense of self is seen through. So it's basically part of it is where we have to kind of practice it until there's a depth of insight that it actually transforms us. You know, but you think of that gateway of that natural mindfulness, the non-effort mindfulness. Find times that you naturally don't have to run a story. The story may still run, but you can kind of bring forth the immediate experience to the foreground. So the story becomes less and less emphasized. All right. Does that help a little, Monica? Thank you, Monica. All right. Anyone else? Maybe one more? Yeah, go ahead, Austin. We can get both of you.
I just wanted to encourage myself and all of us, and I journaled it, to keep open the possibility that Buddhism in this country, the entry point for many people, may not be meditation in the future. I think for me it was, but there are areas like grief and palliative care,
right? Or, yeah,
you know, Buddhist philosophy about how to relate to death.
Yes.
You know, there are different entry points beyond meditation that it feels like in this moment may become more and more alive for people who are new to the practice.
Yeah. Thank you, Austin. If we did a survey, there's probably people who, you know, really led through those entry points instead of meditation. So that's absolutely true. And probably will deepen more and more, especially as the knowledge base becomes more and more accessible. All right, did you, yeah.
Hi, when you said those words about when you let go of an idea or a fixed, you know, belief or want, it can feel like, oh, this feels so much easier. Why was I making it so hard? Like, why was I so, you know, fixed in my sense of self? And my question is, there are times when I will have that feeling of like, oh, I just like, you know, if I let go, like, oh, this just feels so much easier. I feel a sense of relief. And, but I'll feel really good in the moment, but I'll notice, you know, for example, if, you know, I'm in a conflict with someone, I want this, no, I want that, or I have this view, I have this view, and I'll let go. But if I do it too many times, I start to feel like, wait, why am I always the one letting go? And I sort of start to feel a sense of like erasure of self rather than, I mean, I don't know. Can you comment on that or offer guidance?
Sure. Yeah, I think it's, you bring up a lot of good points there, because I think if we take any one approach completely, you know, without being more balanced, we're going to get into trouble, right? So part of what you're talking about is that a sense of relinquishing or letting go, but in terms of relationship, then it becomes maybe unbalanced. That sometimes you need to say, okay, actually, I'm going to hold a line here. I'm going to hold my belief so that there's can be a sense of the relationship growing from that, you know, that navigation. So, you know, there's also the territory of boundaries and, you know, that sense of self-esteem or that sense of having my own voice heard. And so it's like that lens, sometimes it's helpful to, here's my good rule of thumb, my simple rule of thumb. Notice whatever your tendency is, you know, and do opposite of that. And that's going to be the greatest area of growth, right? So if you're always, you know, because we can also be very accommodating, but sometimes that becomes blending into, what do you call it, codependency and all those different qualities. So, okay, maybe I need to be a little bit more assertive and not so easygoing. And so part of it is we start to be able to just play with it, you know, and we don't have to invest it anyway, either which way. I guess that's one thing I look at for myself and with students is that if they have a set point, this is kind of where they're used to being, their repertoire, their home base of acting and being and seeing from. Learning to loosen that up, that's going to often lead to more freedom. Does that help a little bit? Yeah, thank you. Sure.
So is letting go of, so let's say there is a conflictual situation and you say, I'm going to let go and not engage into it. Mm-hmm. Is that considered like not self, or it's just yourself like moving aside to like just let the bullet go? When not self will really be, you try to be like, I don't know, less dense, and it doesn't, it goes through you, but it doesn't affect you, and you just like observe it, and it's like, I'm not avoiding the discussion or the conflict, I'm seeing it and I'm facing it, but it just doesn't affect me.
It can be all of those. Okay. You know, so, not to be confusing, but the actual actions, it's like it's the internal perspective is kind of the core piece there, right? So there can be the skill of navigation of relationships or interactions. There can be the non-skill of it, right? Now our patterns kick in. But a lot of it is like that, is, am I kind of the, how should I say it? There's this, the sense of self falling away is a very profound seeing and insight. You know, basically, there's not this, the sense of me doesn't, you just don't see it anymore. It's not there anymore. You can't find it in the same way. Now, how you still interact may look lots of different ways. You might be holding this view or this perspective, or you may be stepping outside, but that sense of you isn't there anymore in the same way. Yet you can still seem very relational and very connected. You're just not, you know, you're not, that sense of me isn't believed in the same way, right? Or I could have a sense of me that's still believed in and I'm doing things to help soften it or loosen it, or I'm doing things to make that more solid and rigid. Does that help? Is that probably more confusing?
It's okay.
Yeah, this can get very confusing very quickly. All right, well, with that... I'll let Carrie sort all that out next week. just ask her that question next week. And if she can't answer, you can ask Tuari Salon the next 2 weeks after that. And Steve Wilhelm be here the last week of July. All right. All right. Thank you all. And have a good evening. Thank you for all your questions and this engagement. And have a safe 4th. All right. Goodbye, everyone online.